So we now come to the final talk of this symphony that we've put together for you from Professor Charles Jenks, who, as you will have heard, was the founder of postmodernism as an architectural historian, and now he's working in cosmology and landscape. And so he's really the sort of Renaissance man, the universal man, and you can see this in the symbolism that he has for you, which I think I remember seeing in a previous talk that somebody gave on alchemy, maybe Anne Baring, you know, quite a long time ago. And anyway, it's a huge pleasure to have Charles with us to give another perspective, which he's calling Harmony and Disharmony in the Universe, but this would be with reference to a number of different fields covering his experience. So perhaps you'd help me welcome Charles, and we're very much looking forward to his talk.
Thank you all for that, and David, and the SMN network for having me. I'm really pleased to be talking today on harmony and disharmony. I will be introducing a slight twist to the theme, and but I don't know anywhere else where you could debate these kind of very basic questions with scientists and mystics and people in the medical profession, and I'll talk a bit about that at the beginning. I have a confession to make to you. Of course, I haven't spoken or been to an SMN meeting for 20 years. I last spoke in 1995, so I'm a lapsed SMN member, and I confess it to you and ask for your forgiveness. Like a lapsed Catholic, you know, I get down on my knees. Anyway, I have been, though, reading your network review religiously for 20 years. I read a lot of journals, and it keeps me in touch, so I feel as if I haven't left. And I've been very influenced by your keeping thoughts and feelings together alive at the same level. And I've learned in particular from Marilyn, who's helped me with the epigenetic landscape, which I'm working on with another friend of mine, because we all feel that the epigenetic so-called revolution is very important in today's thinking, in helping us rethink why evolution goes so fast and in a way that wasn't vanilla Darwinian evolution. Anyway, landscape is a great place to work all these things out because unlike in science and religion, you can't not get tenure if you hold a position which isn't part of the standard dogma. And interesting, of course, they talk about the standard dogma, Crick and Watson's standard dogma in DNA genetics, the standard dogma in the church. And landscape allows me and others, I think, to speculate about the laws of nature and the universe in a way that you have done in very convivial atmosphere, both collectively and with music and singing and interaction and on a one-on-one intimate conversation between meetings. I think this is unique. I don't know of another institution quite like this, although Satish has his own, the Schumacher I've been to. And, you know, your affinities, your elective affinities are very close. So I'm really happy to be here. One more little point that I want to make, or 2 points, before I start as a kind of polemic. I'll show it rather than argue it. But the first one is about harmony. I argue, which I think is accepted by everybody here, that harmony is real and not just a human projection or an animal projection. It's real in the universe. It precedes all life, and it will post-seed all of life too. Harmony is real and deep and important. And beauty, which comes from harmony, is also real and not a projection, as the modernists in David Hume and many philosophers have held it's, you know, it's an epiphenomenon. No, it's deep. So far, so good. But so is disharmony and ugliness, deep and real. And many other things, of course, too, besides the two. Boredom is also deep and real. And the interesting thing to me, for an artist and landscaper and culture generally, is that you're interested, all artists really are interested in the relation between harmony and dissonance, coming back to harmony, going away from it, the tensions. You know, just to have a harmonious universe is the sound of one hand clapping. And if I may, you know, make a critique of the listening to pulsars and listening to black holes and listening to the universe, it's kind of on the boring end of music. I think the universe is much more interesting than that, and I accept the anima mundi as well as the, I accept the right brain. And I think the history of aesthetics does too, completely, that, you know, the universe and we are about feeling, passion, interaction, relating, all of those emotional qualities. So aesthetics can deal with these different languages of the beautiful and the ugly, and I'll get into that. The other point I want to make, which might be contentious, is about today's cosmology. I'll be ending with the multiverse, which I know is on the index for many people, including a lot of my friends. It seems to be, our universe seems to be favoring a multiverse view today of many universes, and it's very difficult to think about and to feel about. Now, let's admit that from the start. And let's also go back to Plato, which I will be doing from time to time, and the Platonic or the Pythagorean harmonic view of a unified universe, a universal universe, to put another metaphor on it. It's very hard to think about a multiverse or even our universe where the laws might be different, isn't it? I mean, it's the end of science, as famous books have been written in the last 20 years, because if the universe is different in different parts, it's not universal. And so you have to kind of emotionally hold that in. And Martin Rees, who is a good friend, has raised this question. We're doing, in June 21st, we open the first multiverse in the universe, as I said the other night, up in Scotland. Of course, it's a joke, paradox. How can the multiverse be in the universe? Well, we built one, so it can. But it's emotionally hard to think about and intellectually hard to think about. And I think there's a very positive aspect to it. I resisted it myself, to confess again, on taste grounds, and so did Plato. The multiverse idea was very strong in pre-Socratic Greek science, and then Plato, more or less in Aristotle, following, and science since that time have more or less said no, no, no. I remember in the 60s and 70s where you couldn't get tenure in a university if you didn't subscribe to the black hole theory and, you know, the standard Big Bang cosmology, Big Bang, you know, bang, bang, bang. It's kind of Pentagon language of the universe. I remember that James Bond 007 is called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in Italy. Well, the universe, as we know, is incredibly silent, and it didn't start with a bang. No one heard it. The music wasn't there because it doesn't travel through. Well, it might have traveled in a plasma wave. Anyway, I'll ask Bernard about that later. But bad metaphors, I think, should be critiqued. And part of my work as a landscape designer is to critique the selfish gene, you know, wimps and machos, the Big Bang, all of this language is aggressive and alienating. Because I think we are universe stuff. And I start off the talk with a kind of picture dedicated to our pilgrim, okay? And just, you can decode it. It's a very interesting drawing, a painting, colored here. I'm not going to say, I'll end with a little thing on it. I want to talk a bit about, my work with Maggie Centers, my late wife Maggie, who I worked with on a cancer caring center, and then after she died, I named it after her. And we published a book in 2010 called The Architecture of Hope with Frank Gehry's building in Dundee, this little jewel of a building, jewel of the cosmos. And I think you can see it's on the River Tay in Dundee. And let's see if I can do the mouse here or here. Oh, yeah. Okay, so the River Tay is here in Dundee. And Frank, being... let me just switch the mouse because I'm right-handed. Well, let's see if I can. I'll have to be left-handed, so I might get it in the wrong place. Anyway, Frank picked the most beautiful site in a mass NHS hospital for this, right beyond the helicopter landing pad, overlooking the River Tay and looking towards the mountains of Dundee you see across the river. You may know that the most greatest tragedy occurred on Christmas Day when the bridge over the Tay collapsed in the, I think, 1900 and killed, you know, virtually everybody on it. So engineering went wrong, harmony went wrong, and a lot of death happened, accident. And tragedy affects everybody with cancer. Now, the thing about one way or another is that Frank, like all of our architects, and we've had 1820, all designing to the same program, picked a cosmic site, and a site which is meant to engender hope. What is hope? Hope is a big metaphor. It's hope about a projection to the future horizon. So all of our architects use that as a metaphor of architecture. Doctors are meant to cure you, and they're oriented to the future too. So the doctor's profession and the architectural profession are both oriented to the horizon. And so natural metaphors of hope are this, include the horizon and the cosmos. And that's the first idea, which is common to my work and common to these 20 buildings or so. I didn't have a very deep idea about hope when I wrote the first edition of this. But I'll tell you that my late wife, Maggie, said to me before she died, it was the best year of her life. Really counterintuitive, because she had a death sentence of cancer, you know, 2 months to live. And then we did a lot of primary and secondary work, and she lived a year and 8 months. And in it, she exercised and ate well and did all the right things, as well as take primary high-dose chemo. And she lived her death sentence by, you know, about 18 months. Incredible. When all the oncologists said, "You're dead." And what inspired her was hope, of course, of intellectual kind and of a physical kind. That became the inspiration for our Maggie centers after she died, because they're patient-oriented centers, self-help centers, where a lot of the information exchange is between people, individuals, individual psychologists, and then group psychology and sociology, and all these. We run a very complex service with some very simple ideas. You see in the upper set of pictures the orientation towards the future and the cosmos and the horizon in many different centers, or between walls to the horizon, to the sky, the sun. And you see in below another metaphor of hope, which is intimacy. Because when you have cancer, you know, you have hope on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and then on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, you know, you have side effects and suffering, and you're in another space. And so Maggie's is to turn hope, to renew hope, and you do it socially as well as individually, in intimate spaces. So all of those are the kind of meditation rooms, the kind of spaces with fountains and bamboo, very modest, small inglenooks, warm spaces, as against mutual big spaces. So hope is many little things as well as one big orientation, which has to be renewed. And I won't go into what we do, but this tree of Maggie's, which I put together to explain that, shows about 20 different activities on a weekly basis, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, with NHS hospitals who can't do the kind of thing we can do, which is take time. Doctors have 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes often to, you know, explain very complicated things to patients in the NHS. And they have all these, the NHS, as you know, is shrinking. And so we've taken up a lot of the slack. For instance, we have one of our things is where to get a loan, how to get a loan, how to use the state system, to get money. And if you have cancer, you know, it's not just the physical problems. You have a whole lot of social problems. Your hair falls out if you're getting chemo. Where do I get a wig? What do I do about that? Some of the answers come from other patients. Some come from our carers. We have professional carers. And this diagram is meant to show you that. I don't want to go into it. You can't read it, so don't try. Anyway, one of the funny things we found, and it was completely unintuitive to me, because I argued against architectural determinism, that architecture could change society. But we found with having good architects designing good buildings supported the carers. And if you support the carers well and you put them in a good building, then they support the patients. And you create a virtuous circle. I hadn't thought of that until I debated an NHS medic on the radio, and he and I disagreed. I said, you know, architecture can't change society. And he said, you're completely wrong. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, in a bad NHS building, we, the doctors, don't show up for work. I hadn't thought of the negative case. You can prove the negative, that bad buildings, you know, have low usage by doctors. And if you don't have a doctor showing up for work, you're in deep trouble. So negative architectural determinism, you can prove. And I now see that we create a virtuous circle by looking after the carers so well, caring for them, they care for the patients. And I do believe there is an indirect effect, a feedback effect of architecture on the people. And I won't go into that, but we could debate in questions. Let me say, Maggie Centers are not a franchise. We're not McDonald's. We don't produce the same layout in every center. And this is very rare. You know, even the Cistercian churches were more or less a franchise. So if you went from Cito to Yorkshire, Revo, anywhere to a Cistercian, you knew where the dortoir was to the right and the refectoire was to the left, and you know, you could see where the church was. But the Cistercians did, and many people who have companies and, you know, organizations are tempted in a modern world to repeat, repeat, repeat. You can see 8 of our 20 centers here. Again, you can't read them, but you get the point. The same program produces postmodern variety. And that's a real help for us. Of course, all sites are different, and every architect is different. And although we always give them the same architectural program, they produce 18, 20 different versions. And they compete now against each other. And, you know, so that we have now a virtuous circle where no architect can afford to fail if they're designing a Maggie Center, because it becomes public. And it's helpful for us. I want to come back to hope, and hope is really an interesting faith, hope, and charity. Hope is a really interesting idea. It's not only a projection to the future, but it takes belief. Belief is very important with hope. It's not the same as faith, but it takes belief. It takes hard work. It's not optimism. Okay? Optimism is different. Optimism is a punt on the stock exchange, or optimism is the weather. You know, it'll be better weather tomorrow when I see. Hope, you've got to work on hard, and it needs to be renewed. I compare it metaphorically to a rusting chain. Hope is a chain that's always rusting and always needs repair. You've got to reaffirm it. And I show you a picture of self-portrait Maggie that she showed me a little bit. She did after a 1500 German expressionist painting of the Eisenheim altarpiece by, I can't remember the Grunewald. And which is really shows a suffering Christ. It's bloody, it's nasty, it's full of pain. And Maggie was doing a version of that for a friend who was dying. And she did this self-portrait, and you can see fear all over it, right? She didn't show it to me. I found it after her death. You know, David, it's interesting, there was a show on at the National Gallery showing why the British rejected German art of that period. It was a whole show. I don't know if you saw it, but it's really interesting that for taste reasons, just as Plato rejected the multiverse on taste reasons, culture reasons, the British refused to collect German expressionist art of the 15th to 18th centuries. So they only had three paintings from that period in the National Gallery, and 2 years ago they had a big exhibition on why they repressed it. So Maggie was Scots English, but she, you know, she was looking at this for a way of being, a way of thinking, feeling. So the Architecture of Hope now, the new edition, which has a lot of more abilities, much more complex thing, which discusses hope and fear as a duality, as an oscillation. Now, shifting gears, I want to make a plea that, you know, the world of art and aesthetics cuts across a kind of unification, which is in science and religion. And I show you Akhenaten, this great, interesting pharaoh of 1450 BC, or thereabouts, 1420 BC. And he's called the first individual in the world, in world history, the first individual. Whether or not he is considered so is debatable, of course, because it's hard to define what an individual is. But he's not only that, but he introduced monotheism well before Moses, 80 years before Moses. And his monotheism, like his name, Akhenaten, was worship of the Aten, worship of the sun. And it was a cosmic worship. And he brought up in Thebes, father was the pharaoh, and there were 85,000 priests in Thebes, and he couldn't stand too many bureaucrats. So he left, and he took the whole, you know, bureaucracy to Amarna, where it was much hotter, and he worshipped the sun, and he laid it out as a sun diagram, by the way. And he produced, his wife was Nefertiti, an icon of beauty since the 20s, and they have amazing proportion of his neck and her neck and his face and her face and his sort of androgyny and her androgyny. Some people think he was suffering from a disease. In any case, what's so interesting about this painting, although it's lost its paint, is like many of his works, it was cosmic, but it shows the sun as a friendly sun. And it shows his daughters, and in royal portraits and in portraits of that time, it didn't exist to show these intimate family relationships. So for me, it's the first cosmic art in the West, and it shows his three daughters, miniature versions of Nefertiti, and he pointing to each other, he's kissing, and you know, pharaohs didn't kiss in public. They showed no public emotion, by the way, wasn't allowed for 2,000 previous years. Now, he's not only kissing his child there, but the children, like the son, are pointing to each other, pointing in dialogic, if you like, dialogue, and intimately involved with them. And if you look closely at the son, you'll see that the son has the same hands and pointy fingers as the, you know, as their children. So what, you can just hear the words between them. It's a very moving example of cosmic art. And for me, you know, a challenge to be as good as that. Now, the Garden of Cosmic Speculation, I won't take you through much of it, just one little part or two parts. But it brings up the question of the relation between the cosmos and nature. Because in our language, we think of nature as living and alive and growing and biological, like us. But of course, according to cosmic history, there was, in our case, there was 9 billion years of unliving matter before there was living matter about 3.8 or 4 billion years ago. If the universe is 13.82 billion years big, which is what meditation of science tells us, then the cosmos was around a long time before it produced life and nature. And here is a linguistic problem for us, because if you think on another level, then, you know, you need gravity, don't you? Which is not living in the usual sense. You need gravity and electromagnetism and strong and weak force, all the forces of nature. I say forces of nature now, you see? Forces of the cosmos. Before things can grow and change the way living things do. So the laws of nature, gravity is a law of nature, pull together what we tend to divide, that is the inanimate and the animate. And I think today, living as we do in this period when We know self-organizing systems which are not alive can still produce life-like things. And so the cosmos doesn't mean alive, but it means related to nature. And I show on the cover here a typical Scottish thing, which is it's raining and the sun is out at the same time, all right? Which produces this wonderful dark sky. And I've trapped the sun, like Akhenaten, not above, but in below, in the water. So these are metaphors and artistic metaphors. And it's a landscape of waves. I heard a lot this morning about waveforms, and there's water waves here. This is the plant of the garden. And there's DNA waves, and there's the train waves, the sound waves. Train goes by here. You can see in the upper right there, train waves. And then there's contour waves, contour maps, which are waveforms of how the Earth self-organizes in levels, in paths, and so forth and so on. Waveforms underlie everything in the universe, as do particle forms. And so my landscape of waves, which this painting is of, shows, since we've privileged the particle, I felt this garden should be a polemic about waves. So looking at these languages that have developed over the last 30 years from science, strange attractors became an idea, and these landforms articulate in the top is a strange attractor that pulls in towards a self-similar landscape of water and a causeway, and you can see the drawing to the left, and then in back you can see how it twists towards the fence, the cows, and the outside world. So we find that the language of strange attractors underlies a lot of cosmic things, a lot of self-organizing systems. And so it's one of the languages I've incorporated here. Waveforms. And there's a DNA garden, which is a critique of the selfish gene, and it's about how cells communicate with each other. And you see these, it's also the garden of the six senses. There's six cell walls there, and the center of each cell is a nucleus, and in the center of each nucleus is a DNA, and the DNA comes out and is read by the ribosomes, and so forth. So it's partly to do with truth here, and translation and metaphor of DNA. You see in the lower right a teaching model of of molecules, and what I was trying to do, or always trying to do, is capture the expressive and meaningful in the rendition of DNA at the atom of life. And so it doesn't look like the teaching model, but it's constrained by the truth of what scientists tell us. And so you can see the DNA garden from the air here, looking down at the six different cells and the nucleus and how they unfold and are transformed into planting. Since all plants work off DNA, it's using nature to celebrate nature and to represent it and to symbolize it. And representation and symbolism are two different things. And in one part of it, in one of these six cells, there's a cell of touch, taste, all the sensorium of a garden. You experience it through the senses. The sixth sense is called the female sense, the sense of anticipation or sense of the future, a sense of intuition. That's called the sixth sense. All these senses. And it's interesting, it's that you see a woman down in the bottom of this DNA, and she sits there on a spring, and as the waves of the wind come through, she bounces, and she's looking at her brain. It's a picture of a head looking at her brain, and her brain bounces, and her brain has fingers on it, connected up, because, of course, your fingers are highly sensitive, aren't they? So the sense of touch is one of the senses of the six. And the neurons, pick up the vibrations. I asked Maggie what the sense of the female sense was, and she said, "Oh, it's a feeling of what's going to happen." And she did this with her hands in the air, fingers. Then I found out that Einstein said, had written that what is the most important thing for a scientist? It's a feeling at the end of the fingertips of what's going to happen. Fingerspitzengefühle. It's my only word of German. And It's interesting. So he said a good scientist had to have a sense of what's going to happen next, a sense of intuition. So the garden celebrates that in many ways. And Jim Watson, a friend, and of course a very interesting character, who's often speaks his mind a little bit too much, asked me to do DNA at where he and Crick discovered our soul from Rosalind Franklin, depending on your point of view, the idea of the double helix, and put it together with a whole lot of different things, including a model. Remember, they modeled it, and architectural models are very important. Beauty is very important. He said, and here he and I are talking here, and I'm pointing out some various things, at Clare College, that beauty was essential in the universe, essential for DNA. And in a way, he's a very strong Platonist by saying that. Anyway, that's what he believed. He was critiqued by scientists. And it's interesting that Umberto Eco, who I know quite well, wrote maybe 10 or 15 years ago a book called On Beauty, the History of Beauty in the Western World. And it's a beautiful book in itself. You should buy it. Beautifully laid out, beautiful illustrations, very interesting. And he discusses 20 or so different theories of beauty, all of which look to be true in a deep sense. Rather interesting. And he finds, so it sold so many copies, still in print, that his publisher said, well, you've got to write another book. What is it going to be? And Umberto thought, well, I'll write on ugliness. And he discovered a rather interesting thing, that if you compare beauty, all the writings on beauty from Plato to the present, and probably the Egyptians to the present, they outnumber the words and the thoughts on ugliness by about 10 to 1, just what you said yesterday was the most of the world is peaceful and harmonious, don't fetishize the 5%. Well, let's admit that the beauty is more attractive than ugliness. But let us not let us not throw out theories just because they're ugly. That became even in the Gothic age there were gargoyles and grotesques, and in Chinese art, you know, there's a love of the ugliness, and the phrase "it's so ugly, it's beautiful" is understandable. So they're both ugly and beauty are part harmony and disharmony, part of aesthetics. But harmony, and we saw a lot of musical waveforms, Pythagoras, coming from Pythagoras. Here's the monochord. This is Robert Flood, the English mystic scientist, who did some beautiful drawings. And he's showing the fine-tuning of the universe. God is fine-tuning. It's beautiful, isn't it? The metaphor becomes literal. The hand comes out of the cloud. And I can't take you through this fully, but it is a cosmological drawing and an idea of the harmony of the world. And he starts off with Terra at the bottom, then the four forces, the four Greek, earth, air, water, and fire, earth at the bottom, that's where we are. Then you look up, you look to the left and you see the proportions, which we heard about this morning, of the monochord. This is a monochord cut in half, octaves, and so forth, as Jean-Philippe explain, and on the right are the numbers and the letters, and then as you go through the sphere, or the heavenly sphere of the stars, you get into the underlying Platonic universe. About 40 or 50 years later, the great Baroque theorist and mystic scientist was Kircher, who did drawings which every Baroque architect and painter and musician and so on looked at. I mean, his work was the most popular at the time, went all through Europe. And he showed amazing intuitions about the sun, flares. I mean, he couldn't see solar flares. But he used analogy of volcanoes, and he predicted, you know, the sun is a violent place. It's not just a peaceful, quiet place. It's full of explosions. And these are his drawings, and they're very interesting for us, because there's a book that I've taken this from, by the way, that's out, Michael Benson's Cosmographics. I recommend it to you. Just out last September, cosmic graphics. It's the visualization of the cosmos over the last 2,200 years. Beautiful. And it shows that, like us, people at any one time in history are looking back and looking forward, but there's truth in all of this and there's falsity or things. Anyway, I was asked to do a thing in the Botanic Gardens in Dublin and by an RNA man, RNA, which is not as well known as DNA, and they asked me to do a both for Jim Watson and others because in Dublin is a key place where Schrödinger and others went and what his life was written. So this the Botanic Garden wanted to have a demonstration of all this. So I did a kind of epigenetic landscape in the back, and there's a seat which is based on these theories of how RNA works in shifting elements. I won't explain that. And it says there's an arrow coming from RNA which says RNA controls. You see the arrow coming through the ground towards the DNA, and then the DNA is accepting it. It controls DNA expression. Okay, so here's part of the epigenetic revolution. RNA is telling DNA what to do. DNA is a beautiful woman on in a certain level who has stored all this information and pirouettes around doing, all those exercises we were doing yesterday. I can't remember them all. But they're just metaphors, what I'm saying. But I was interested in exploring the ugliness of RNA, this male ugliness, who is always contorted and angst-ridden and messed up and non-harmonic. Because RNA we're now investigating with as much interest as DNA. And there are only 6 molecules of RNA, or at least when I was doing this, that were fully understood and represented, and they were viruses. They were killer viruses. Interesting. And so the back of this landscape shows the ugly things. And there's one where the RNA silencer attacks a hammerhead virus. And so you can see them, this contortion and ugliness going on, but it's an essential part of life, and RNA tells DNA often what to do. So coming back to Plato and God, the architect of the universe, this wonderful moralized Bible, you see God, omniscient, male, laying out the universe with a protractor, with a compass, earth, air, water, and fire, in the circle according to the cosmology of Aristotle and the time, and the moon and the sun you can see there. But you see that water, actually, interesting that water is chaotic. So there was a room for chaos of self-organizing things that are beyond us, even at that time. On the other side is a view from WMAP of 2003, not as sharp focus as it was in 2013, and it shows the universe, and I've colored it all up and put an eye in it, an eye reflecting back on the universe. It's our mental and physical relationship through astronomy and through all of our techniques of transducing the signs, the signals, the waveforms that come from outer space, with that red blood cut of the Milky Way, which gets between us and the universe. When you look at the universe, in anything, you'll see the Milky Way, partly in your way of the dust. So there's order there. You can see I've started underline the order in this transformation. And while I was doing all this, I was working on quarks, and they were mentioned this morning, this beautiful languages of quarks, when you look at subatomic explosions created by taking particles and aiming them toward each other. They meet and they create a three-dimensional explosion, which is reflected in the water below. But it's the explosion which has to be looked at closely. And of course, at CERN is where that happens, where you accelerate things to the speed of light. And you have to look at 50,000 photographs in this case before they got the first quark. And so above in the garden there is the actual explosion, and below is a projection onto film of what the first sight of a quark. And then we know, you know, the standard model was of physics, the standard dogma too, was formulated, and then I wrote that on the side there, above these explosions, to explain it to people in the garden, the quarks, the eightfold way is in the background of red, and there is the standard model in stone of what in our time, 2002 and 3, it was, and we discovered all the quarks. Every time we knew where to look, we looked and we found it. We spent billions of dollars to do that, but it's incredible. It's one of the first projects where the theory, the mathematics, and these things led us. But you see, the model is falling apart. And it's falling apart because at that stage, we didn't find the Higgs, and it was missing. No one could find it. And the Higgs is foregrounded there with dot, dot, dot around it, the Higgs boson. We couldn't find it. We couldn't trap a Higgs. And Higgs himself, Peter Higgs, lived 80 miles from this garden, and he was very modest. He didn't come out of his house. So how to trap a Higgs? Well, I managed to do that. And here he is looking down at his boson. Before it was found, by the way, he came into the garden, and he brought CERN with him, and they invited me to do a garden around their central globe. And I won't go into that, but to show you that at the center of things are question marks, two question marks, very small, very big. And this is based on the famous Ouroboros figure, snake eating its tail. And I'm sure you know, we've heard a lot about this from Bernard. I won't go into it. This is an American version with Midgard, our middle level there, you know, the human level, somewhat midway between the very big on the right and the very small on the left. And you see the supposition here. It's really interesting. The two things about this diagram, or maybe more, it was done for CERN, by the way, by Glashow, I think, in 1977. And it's a thinking tool which scientists accept, and that's why I used it as a metaphor for the garden design. But of course, the universe isn't exactly a snake head eating its tail. And of course, there's a lot in the grand unified theory, the gut there. It's a supposition that the very small and the very big will be the same or relate, right? That's that's the theory, that they'll come together. But of course, we don't know that that's true. We don't know. It's a question mark. And maybe the universe isn't a universe. Maybe it evolves in a way, you know, with jumps, and there's no relationship in the end between the very small and the very big. But we assume, and science goes forward, assuming there's a unification there. So CERN is involved. Its big project is to use the very small to determine the very big. And that's why I use this. But and it shows some fascinating things. Anyway, to jump again to another project, I'm very much into symbolic landscape design. And in a period when the clients and the people who commission landscape or buildings don't know what to symbolize, it's very hard to get any symbolism through, any. And that's why our environment looks so dull and uninteresting, blank and boring, the dumb box, as Venturi and many postmodernists have said, because no one knows what to pay for, no one knows what to symbolize. In any case, in Korea, I got this commission, and then I gave it partly to my daughter, Lily. We worked on it, and it was an ecological commission for a city of 400,000 people, which you see in the background there, trying to reinvent itself in an age of decline, industrial decline, reinvent itself as an ecological center of the world. And they happen to have, it's Sunchun City, if you look it up on Google, Sunchun City happens to have a great wetland and a great number of species at the bottom of this river, which you see traveling through the city. What the Koreans do not necessarily perceive is that because 70% of Korea is mountainous, it's part of their everyday life. They build in the valleys, but they don't perceive the mountains. They go out and walk in them, but they don't perceive how extraordinary that landscape is. And so what Lily and I worked out here was, holding the eco line, how to, a symbolic landscape to preserve the ecology. And they asked us to be at the center of 84 gardens made by landscape architects around the world to occupy that center and pull it together. And so we came up with this, holding the line. Hold this line. Don't build any more buildings south where this great preserve is. And we gave them a lot of ideas for this, which they built very quickly, amazingly quickly. But also what we did, because the mountains surround their ecological wetland, we wanted to draw in the mountains, to miniaturize them, to pull them in, to borrow the landscape. And so we built 7 mounds around their central mountain. It's called Bonghua Mountain, which is the center of 400,000 people. They have this mountain called Bonghua. And we turned the city into the wetland, to the lake. And their river, which you see here going by, we turned into our bridge. So it's a direct metaphorical mapping of their ecology of 50 miles onto our project. You can see the far mountains on the left. They're miniaturized by our mounds in the foreground. So as you get on their mountain and you look through, you literally see in the miniatures what the far mountain is. It's capturing the landscape. And we use photographs broken up to show that. So, you know, we have to communicate our symbolism to the public, to a mass public. In any case, we had our problems, but in the end, we were invited out to the opening in April 2013. And it was an extraordinary opening where they used our metaphor and our ideas as a performance space. So we were amazed to see what happened. First of all, their metaphor of the stork, it's a black-headed crane, which is their goddess of the town, their mascot, and 100 women dressed up as the headed crane, and with one as the goddess, and they performed, they look as if they're walking down the water, actually they're dancing on a slightly sunken platform. While music comes all around, you can see the music amplification system, 10,000 people, 3,000 performers and 10,000 people watching. It was like an Olympic opening, which lasted for 2 hours, and the gratifying thing was that they used both traditional and modern, both high art and low art, and cutting across all these taste cultures to perform their myths and their beliefs and their hopes and their future. So you see a marching band below, pom-poms, and you see the medieval yellow-garbed military uniforms, wonderful, the military of the 14th century. It went on for about 2 hours, this performance, with women in regional dress here, rowed on rubber boats by the youth as they came through. And then there were jet skis. There was every possible performance. And then a shaman came through. Shamanism, by the way, was disallowed for 20 years by a modernist dictator in Korea. And it's roared back. It's interesting. The Koreans are natural-born animists, and they in a garden and a landscape, of course, they were allowed. So here's the boatman with his medieval hat, and he was singing poetry, and he was rowed through. Very moving and very musical. Then all of a sudden, a pop band came in playing, very loud, deafening music. There were explosions. Bombs went off. Industrialization occurred. These pylons exploded with electricity. Things, the whole city looked like their industrial wasteland on our mounds. And incredible raucous noise and conflict and disorder and ugliness came in. And the stork goddesses were killed off. And the main goddess was ran away to the Bonghua Mountain, and she was chased, and her lover, she and her lover were chased. And Then a factory blew up. Do you see the factory in balloons? Rubber factory. So it was a kind of interesting popular celebration of their myth, of reinventing themselves ecologically. Then the people, the motorcycle gangs came in, the young, revving their machines, and they chased her up the hill, and she ran and ran to get to the top, and finally she was hit just before she got to the top, knocked over. You know, all of this was being sung and danced and announced and performed in front of us. Anyway, you can imagine what happened next. She lay there, and then a stretcher came out, the hospital people came out, and then there was kind of silence, and then all of a sudden, the youth of Sun Chun came in, triumphant, carrying her as in her new guise. She was healed, and all of the people from the towns and the other designers sang the Ode to Brotherhood, a kind of Beethovenian thing. So a really interesting kind of way symbolic landscape can lead to new things. Now, so I've tried to do this in all my landscape, but I have to say it's usually I have to slip it in, and the client goes crazy when you talk about it, and you don't get paid to do this. They pay you not to do it. Okay, so you have to fight every inch of the way. I was given, often have coal sites to repair, and in 2005, Richard Buccleuch, the Duke of Buccleuch, asked me to come in and repair this one for a bankrupt coal company. Happens all the time now in Scotland. They're all bankrupt, really. And these sites, it's really cynical because, of course, people dig for coal, and knowing if they don't find it, they can go bankrupt, and so they don't have to restore the site. In any case, when I came upon it, I was really discouraged. It was desolate. Nothing was growing. It was a desert in the wettest part of Scotland. Strange desert. Eerie. I mean, actually quite beautiful in a kind of visceral way, but ugly too and scarred. And then slowly I began to understand there was a deep beauty to it, even to that ugliness. And I worked on the Croic multiverse. And we found, or I found out about, that nearby, half a mile away, this lunula was found in the 19th century, the Auchentiger lunula. And it's about 2,400 BC, and it's one of maybe 30 great lunulas. And lunula, of course, loon, the moon, and more Irish than Scottish, but the Irish and the Scottish were part of a culture then, which produced these gold lunulas throughout the Atlantic seaboard. And here was buried one of the top ones. So it shouted out, you know, this is a crossroad. It's a place called Sanker, which means old seat, and it's where the Nith River and the high road to Scotland, the Southern Upland Way, cross. So we found out there was a stone circle around there. There was a barrow unexcavated. So an ancient site. And a cosmic one at that. I mean, this was cosmic, these cosmic burial sites. Cairn Holy, even the word cairn and holy, is another example not too far away. And the burial remains of Cairn Holy, this is Cairn Holy 2, can be looked at as a kind of spiritual, through the spiritual glasses, which are no doubt true. They can be looked at through religious classes, although we're not exactly sure of what their religion was. And they can also be looked at as Barbara Hepworth, who was very inspired by it. In other words, through land art and artistic classes. And so I did a lot of cosmic collisions. Here is an early version of one when it was under construction. I'm sitting with Richard Buccleuch and one of the people in our hard hats, and you see us near a cosmic collision point because, of course, asteroids collide, comets collide. The universe is a violent place, and we found, as I was working on the site, 2,000 boulders, and many of them, you know, 15 feet high. And the question was, should we bury them all? Well, I thought, why not show the violence to a different meaning, and I use them as shelter points. So you can shelter in this against wind and rain, which is always happening in this area. And laid out the site, it happened to be north-south, which is wonderful, and there was a natural progression north. So these 2,000 boulders were used in many different ways, the north-south line, and then it was used on the two spiral galaxies. There's our Milky Way galaxy, and there's the Andromeda galaxy, which scientists tell us we'll meet in 3.5 billion years about. They will go through each other, probably, and form an amazing new form. North of that is the supercluster of galaxies, just north of it, and then the multiverse in the foot there. While above it are other usages of these boulders. A quick view down the north-south line to the left, you see between two huge boulders, maybe 15 feet high, looking dead south at the sun amphitheater around which the comets go. To the right of that, a desert. I realized that the desert was wonderful. How to preserve a desert in the wettest part of Scotland? Very interesting. Anti-gardening. But very important, just, you know, as in music, the thing about the landforms in general is versus water and flatness. So you see the two galaxies there to the right, and the supercluster of galaxies in the foreground, and then the multiverse to the further right. And those are the two galaxies stripping each other, with the Milky Way to the right there below, and Andromeda to the left, and the strip there doing the strip, willow strip, Scottish dance. There's another view of it up towards the Omphalos in the north point. And you see the quality of some of these rocks. This was what Stuart Kaufman calls order for free of the universe. You know, I didn't have to do anything more than, you know, take them up to the top of Andromeda, and they frame the landscape. They're so beautiful, the layers and qualities of this red sandstone. We found about 300 or 400 red sandstones. You sit on these spiral elements as if the red sandstone represents matter bending space-time, as Einstein says, then it bends it into a central black hole. And you can sit there having a picnic with your bum on the red sandstone and look into the black hole, which is represented by these rocks cut up, these Nith River rocks, which are only found in the area, which have these self-organizing elements in them. And while we were doing this, we read and we found out that our black hole, the center of the Milky Way, was going to have a feeding frenzy. So interesting to do this kind of design where you, as you're constructing something, then science changes and you construct it. Looking back from Andromeda towards the Milky Way in the distance and the supercluster towards the multiverse, and how to design and show the supercluster. Well, this became very hard, especially since we had no money. We had to do everything from what was on the site. Typical kind of situation. You find yourself as a landscape architect, you know, who... The first thing they cut when they run out of money is landscape, by the way, just to tell you this. And since there was no money in it anyway, we had to do everything from what we had to hand, and we had to do it very quickly by men who sit in big machines and can't see what they're doing. It's extremely hard. It's like Jackson Pollock with heavy machinery and, you know, action sculpture. So I had to explain to these men what the universe was in order to construct it. And I had to, you know, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. And they all were really, really interested by the end of this process. And I had to do models and all these explanatory diagrams and show them what superclusters were and how, you know, you could represent the chaos and the order with the black, dark matter is black and the white matter is what we see and so forth. And while we were doing that, we found in January 2013 a discovery which no one could believe. And here's, that's what it looked like on the left. That's the analysis on the right. And it's a LQG, the Large Quasar Group, just at the edge of the universe. And we found it, you know, through, was it Hubble Deep Field? I don't know how we found it, but we found it. and interpreted it. And we found out that it was 4.5 billion light years big, which is more than twice the size allowed by all theories. So what do you do when you find something that you can't prove? Well, of course, you reject it, don't you? Say, we didn't really see it. Anyway, I decided to build it. And so, you know, it's what is in the foreground, the LQS, Large Quasar Group. And there's a drawing painting of that scene at night where matter radiates out. And the theory of the multiverses and universes is complex to explain in a nutshell, but I was working on this before The Universe in a Nutshell by Stephen Hawking, and this is partly from his book, explained a collapsed universe to the left, a just right fine-tuned universe in the center, and a kinetic universe, which is where the runaway universe is much too, the kinetic force is too strong. And so we're doing that now. It's ending, still under construction. You see a kinetic universe to the left there, and to the right, a universe which is too strong. And you can see they all start off in supersymmetry. They all start off, with this amazing singularity, and then they unfold to inflation. This is the standard model, by the way, of course. It may be wrong, but as far as we know, that's what happens. And they come out like this, and then they either get balanced or they run away and they collapse. So that theory of many universes, however, was thought about, as I say, before Plato, rejected, and came back with Bruno, who was, was burnt at the stake in 1600. And here's a drawing, the Pluralité des Mondes of 1615. And so the many worlds hypothesis, of course meaning something different then, was around, and you see in this case many solar systems. But Thomas Wright of Durham was way ahead of his time, and he was drawing it in a more complex way. Thomas Wright, who we don't know much about, of Durham, influenced Kant, Immanuel Kant, a Scot, by the way, by ancestry. And he, based his whole theory of the galaxies on Thomas Wright. And so the multiverse, the many worlds, has been around. And Bernard can tell us, but I think it's returning. However, my good friend Lee Smolin hates the idea. And he represents a lot of scientists. And it's even stranger because, and here's the thing from January 17th, New Scientist, you think there's a multiverse, get real. And of course, he's attacking it really strongly. And yet, if you can see my writing all over this thing, if you look closely, you'll see in my book, The Garden of Cosmic Speculation, where I interviewed him on, we filmed it, and I transcribe it on page, I think it's 173. Yeah, just read it. And he's explaining the multiverse to me in 1996. So, either he's changed his mind, or Bernard thinks he's got a different view of the multiverse, but anyway, he's gone the other way in a very strong way. So, this is up for grabs. There's the multiverse under construction. And in our opening June 21st, a cosmic moment, we will burn it at the end of the day and celebrate our theories. And by burning it, I suppose we can say it may not be true. It'll be a communal celebration above the coal. You see the coal below. So carbon is us, and we are carbon, of course. So I end with the pilgrim, because as you know from what I've been saying, I've been jumping around in my explorations. I don't know where I'm going, partly. I have very strong ideas about where I've left. Satish, I'm very lucky that I keep sending out messages in bottles and clients come back. I've never seen any. I've never sought a job. But for some reasons, I get picked up and they ask me to do these things. So what you see here, we don't even know the origin of this. But it was the first 1888, Flammarion publishes it. And it's a 15th century kind of woodcut of a beautiful sun and landscape. And a pilgrim has fallen tripped, fallen from a beautiful worldview and the harmony of the spheres there into a new worldview. And he's just hands up. So you can interpret this in many ways. Is that a heartbeat or is it a cosmic rhythm, ritmo del tempo? I leave you with that and questions. Thanks.
Thank you very much indeed, Charles. What a fascinating representation and journey and interface between architecture and science. And I imagine, is your launch on the 21st of June, is that a public event or invitation only?
Yes, absolutely, public event. We can't have too many people because the roads are so narrow in Scotland.
Yes.
But I invite all of you, particularly... to come.
But it'll be covered in the press, though, presumably.
It'll be covered in the press. We haven't gone public. We're probably going public in a week.
Right.
It's in a community called Sanker, S-A-N-Q-U-H-A-R, Sanker, in Dumfries and Galloway, on the River Nith. It's a beautiful old mining town and a beautiful place to be.
And it's on the solstice.
It's on the solstice is the public opening. We have scientists like Bernard coming the night before. So if you really push hard, you can get into those meetings. We have an art the night before that. So art and science is what...
Yeah. Very good. Well, Bernard or somebody, I'd love a write-up of that for the review. And with some photographs, it'd be fantastic. Really interesting. Good. So we've got a few minutes for questions, and then we'll bring... Jean-Philippe up as well. So who'd like to ask anything? We have over here.
Hello, Professor Jenks. It's wonderful to have you here. The Maggie Centres are phenomenal, and I believe there's a new one in Oxford, which is really beautiful, right at the Churchill Hospital, is it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Incredible, how inspiring and wonderful what you're doing. I was hoping someone else would actually ask some more related questions to do with the landscape and architecture, but mine is actually to do with hope, which you started off by mentioning. Doctors apparently are taught how to break bad news, but not how to instill hope. And I asked my brother, who's a GP, why is this? And he said, oh, they're concerned about giving false hope. Now, what is false hope? It's either... do you know what I mean? But one suggestion I have for doctors in their 2.5 minutes to instill a hopeful prognosis, such as by saying, I'm awfully sorry, Mrs. Jones. No, that's what they normally say, sorry, and you've only got 6 months or whatever. But instead by saying, statistics show that 8 out of 10 people with your condition may well not survive more than 6 months. And one may die sooner because they're frail, but one person... may well outlive all of these and may well live a very happy and eventful life. And this could be you, Mrs. Jones, and to give information and literature, you know, the Penny Braun, Maggie Centre, point them in the right direction, instill hope. They've done their job in 2.5 minutes. Thank you.
Perfect, perfect. I mean, I couldn't have said it better. It's true in fact because, you know, when Maggie lost hope, I didn't describe that two to three week crash, and she lost weight, turned white, started to kill herself when she got the death sentence by three oncologists who were extremely nice people, by the way, men. And they said, don't try to fight it. And they told me, they took me aside and pleaded with me, said, you know, we know that you have American contacts as a professor and so on. Don't take her around the world. She can't survive. She's got it, liver and even her brain. She never knew that. She was on the death row. And she took it, you know, as you would take it if you really believed the diagnosis. And then after 2 weeks or 3 weeks, the life force, whatever you call it, the will to live, fought back. And we both had a kind of conversion experience in our bedroom. I don't remember why, but it was, you know, it was the effect. Well, if you're going to die, let's die fighting and die in a better way. Let's go down fighting. And so I That was enough for me. So I called Detroit. I was given the name of a philanthropic institute in Detroit. I called. I'd been in touch with a lot of Americans, by the way, because I have a lot of friends there. And this woman answered. You know, Detroit is a depressed area. And I could tell she was black. And a black philanthropist had given all this money to a library on cancer and so on. And she said, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I'm calling from Scotland. My wife has got terminal breast cancer. And I'm calling you to find out if you can help. She said, absolutely, yes. Tell me her stage and type, and I'll type it in. And so, you know, I said, okay, here's stage, here's the type, had all the genetics done. Okay, I've got 11 articles, 4 books. What's your visa number? That's what she said to me. Within 30 seconds. And they arrived in a day and a half from Detroit to Scotland. And what did she find in that package? It was options and all these articles. And they gave her hope. And you could see, I saw her in front of me grow again, reading this. You know, it was in her head. I finally came across another empowering article, which was written by Stephen Jay Gould, who had terminal cancer, was given 6 months to live. And he asked the very question that you said, or said, you know, statistics. And his article, if you haven't read it, it's a great article. It's called "The Median is Not the Message." The average. We want to position yourself, and he showed this in the long tail of the, and he could do that. And he lived another 20 years, okay? And then he died of cancer, finally. So I gave her that article, and that inspired her and gave her hope. So hope is, yes, it's knowledge, it's positioning yourself, it's working hard. Hope you have to work on. And she says in her wonderful little booklet she wrote before she died, A View from the Front Line, she says to take away hope is wrong for doctors. They must give hope. I think it's very hard for doctors to, you know, to navigate this situation because they are realists and, you know, you can give false hope, but it's no reason to take away hope. So you hit it.
Yeah. Well, I've just got a remark on that because there was Larry Dossey wrote about this in Space, Time, and Medicine a long time ago, and he said this is effectively this sort of death sentence in work is a medical hex. Mm. It's actually a form of curse, because if you then internalize that, then you begin to fulfill what the diagnosis was. And my other little story is I can't remember where I heard this, but this was a man who had terminal cancer, and he was the specialist came to him in the hospital and said, "Very sorry, sir, but there's nothing more we can do for you." And so he went home, and he interpreted that, saying that, "Well, that's all right. I'm going to be fine." And within 6 months, he, you know, his cancer completely disappeared. So
that's also very true.
Yeah. Well, the park that you're designing is opening on the 21st December, June. It's June. Yeah. It's Craywick. It's
Craig.
Craig.
Yeah.
So, well, two questions. One. How will you convey the ideas of the different forms of universe and its history to the visitors? What kind of people do you expect to go? How will they learn that? And two, why will they see that relevant? I mean, I'm fascinated by the universe, but a lot of people say, well, if our galaxy collides with Andromeda in 4 billion years, I don't really care. So why do you, what's the point?
Well, very good questions. First of all, how you communicate, as Umberto Eco and many people have shown, you know, semiotic shows there are many levels of communication, both visceral, underneath symbolic, also symbolic through conventions, through literal icons. So the runaway universes, you know, we're sculpting and we'll write on them. And we'll also have brochures and we'll have television, loop explaining things for those who want to care. It's very complicated because you don't want to explain everything and you want to experience it before you know it in a way, or you want to find out together. And, I hope we can get enough money to be able to communicate these very basic things. But in my experience, often that's cut as well as everything else. So, let's hope we can do that. why should we care about Andromeda in the 3.5 billion years? Well, first of all, we should care because it's contemporary culture. We're discovering that. And I think a cosmic worldview is very intimidating in many ways, and a multiverse is too. And, you know, I'm not against rejecting things on questions of taste. I don't like it because it's ugly. I don't like it because it's boring. I don't like it for many reasons. I think that, you know, one's preconceptions are important and one should never lose them. And we were talking, you know, at the end of Jean-Philippe's thing, I mentioned that I find a lot of the cosmic melodies boring that he was presenting. I mean, it's kind of interesting when it ends in a black hole. Zoom. But, you know, Philip Glass is quite good. But I think that a lot of that kind of direct translation into music of these pulsars is kind of like a metronome, duck, 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 duck. It's like hitting your same, and you can't hear it anymore because it repeats. So the answer is that we are people of the universe, and we have to, through our minds, we can't deny what's being discovered, and we project ourselves animistically into the universe, and I think it's completely inevitable as children, as adults, that we have a direct connection to the universe. We were universe stuff, quintessential universe stuff, and our knowledge about it colors it slightly, and we can't repress it. For one thing, we can't repress it. When it's in the news that we found the largest quasar group, and it's 4.5 billion years, and it's too big for any theory, you know, I think it's madness to, maybe our instruments are wrong, but, you know, it's really exciting. And there is a terrific, I think we're in the golden age of cosmology. And it's never been like this. And it's so interesting. So, you know, we can just hold back and say, oh, I hate it. It's ugly. I don't want to accept it. And then that's what I've done often. I, you know, finally listen. Okay.
Hi. Thanks for a very inspiring talk. I just wanted to pick up on the point of kind of medical buildings, NHS buildings. I'm on the Arts Committee, and Britain's been awarded. There are two sites for a new proton beam therapy centre, one in Manchester and one down in London, and it happens to be within the trust I'm working at. So within our Arts Committee, which doesn't just hang pictures, we are in the process of being embedded. We have one of the big financial directors actually on our committee. And we're in the process now of actually embedding the beginnings of artwork into the building as it's actually being built, which is really exciting because we're actually getting both medics, scientists and patients involved. So that what we're looking at eventually is a completely holistic system of actually moving to a very high-tech building. You actually have empathy. You have, for instance, what you've been speaking about actually the cosmos coming through, so that you're resonating the whole time. So that eventually, even if you are diagnosed with, in quotes, a terminal illness, which I think is a joy, because once you're told you're going to die, you can really live towards death, that there is hope.
Again, I would agree entirely with that, and you know, there's no question there. It's just a perfect statement, yeah.
One very brief question and one slightly longer. The brief question is, how far has Hope Buildings got into the hospice system?
Say that again, how far?
Are we building hospices now on the Hope principle?
The hospice movement is another thing. We're not a hospice. We are, our strapline is living with and beyond cancer, and many people are living with it 10 years or longer. But the hospice movement is quite separate and very interesting in the ways that Maggie's are as a index of change. I think that it's a world movement in brief, but, you know, it's hard to get there because of economic reasons.
Okay. Yeah. Now, my second question is that you limit hope to this life. But if you talk to the dying, yes, they don't.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if this is ever incorporated in your buildings as well.
Yeah. Well, yes, a good question. I mean, obviously, facing cancer brings up the fundamental questions of why am I alive? What is the meaning of life? And what happens after life, my life? And so these are religious and psychic questions, and we have counseling which deals with that. I think we're like a non-denominational church in the sense, if you look at this building type, we often look like a temple or a church or something religious and expressive. And so you could say there is a spiritual component to Maggie's, both architecturally and through the art. We use all the arts, by the way, and landscape. We try to be holistic in that sense, interior design. So all of the arts and cultural forms, I didn't show any of this, but we do not prescribe any particular religion. So, you know, you could say we're spiritual and interdenominational, but not explicitly. We can't take a position on that. We have to be out with, dogma, put it that way. But we don't encourage or discourage patients either way on many points. We don't try to force them to fight for life. And there was a point that people who don't care do very well. I guess you made that point, David. Yeah. So, yeah.
Can we just get Jean-Philippe? Could you just come up? I know Satish has something he wanted to ask Jean-Philippe.
Yes. I'm sorry because after Jean-Philippe spoke. Anyway, thank you, Zanx. It was wonderful. Very much enjoyed your talk. And I also enjoyed Jean-Philippe's talk. I left after his talk, so I don't know if questions were raised about it. But what I felt is that there is a kind of reductionism in your presentation, which says everything can be reduced to numbers. It's one good way to understand the world, music, but also the universe. But there are many other ways. And I, like Charles, like the idea of pluralism and inclusivity. There are many ways. There's no one truth. There are many truths. And plurality of truths includes that mathematically, in numbers, we can understand everything, including music. But love of music, joy of music, spiritual transcendence of music, all those things you cannot reduce to numbers. So I love mathematics, I love numbers. That's one good way, but it's not the only way. That's what comment I wanted to make.
Okay, I would have needed probably 1 or 2 more hours to explain you how I integrate that with everything. So yes, I agree, because from what you've seen, I've just went to the basics of, you know, trying to find these connections. The first part was really like historical connections. I mean, what I wanted you to get back home is that this notion of things that we take for separated today, they were thought in the same way by people at the time. They were not thinking, I mean, I don't think they were reductionist in the way we think in today. Then the second part, where I was, you know, trying to make examples of sounds, I mean, for me, the way I use it when I use that in particular with children is just a way to ask to start asking questions about this phenomena. It's not to say that it reduces to this. Okay, the point is that it's true what you're saying is that after the Second World War and the discovering that, I mean, in fundamental physics, that we have these quarks and fundamental force, and everything reduces like to very elementary particles. There was this feeling, and in particular, if you read Steven Weinberg, that was the hope that there is a finite theory, which is a purely reductionist theory. And we know this is not the case anymore. I mean, most of us, we don't think in this way. So a part is reductionist because this is where the way I was taught about science. But actually, I think, and I can give you texts that I've written, saying that this is not the end of it. We have this notion of different level of description and of complexities. And I've been working and discussing a lot with George Ellis, and he's been working quite a lot on this, how different level of complexity the back react and how you have emergent phenomena and you cannot deny the environment on which you are. And I think I can burp on this to answer one of your questions. You were saying, well, if there are many universes, then the notion of universal does not exist anymore. And I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I mean, we know in science that we have this phenomena which we call symmetry breaking. We know we have some phenomena, and according to the environment in which we look at this phenomena, it looks different. If I take the molecule of water, if I put at different temperature, it doesn't behave the same way. So have different form of ices. And I think this is what we have in mind when we talk about this multiple universe. There is an underlying unified theory, which is always the same, but it appears differently in different part of it. And I think what you were pointing out is...
Can I just...
Yeah, of course.
I mean, the thing is, Martin Rees has brought this out about the multiverse. He says, you know, it's possible either in our universe there are multiple laws, or in many different universes the balances are different, and therefore the theory would be that there aren't any laws that are universal to all these universes. They're only bylaws. It's as if everybody's provincial, you know. It's just like living in a roundabout in Surbiton. And there's no center. There is nothing that's universal to all of them. So I'm not saying this. Martin Rees is saying this. And it's one of the implications, which is upsetting, the thought that that could be true.
Yes.
It sounds like this is addressed to both speakers. Having listened through two very interesting presentations, and they were both excellent, I was nevertheless struck by the absence of the feeling dimension. They were both very intellectual. It was all up here. I'm an astronomer and geophysicist, so I'm not anti-science in any way, and I in fact have made similar presentations to people in Aberdeenshire. And often the kind of reaction I get when I talk about the multiverse or any of these grand subjects is people who say, well, who cares? Why should I care? Here am I trying to understand my life. I'm trying to understand where I came from, why I'm hurting. What can I stop to hurt? What can I do to stop hurting? Why is the universe around me falling apart? What is going on? And you are talking to me about galaxies and multiverses and everything else, which, you know, thank you, you know, once I stop hurting and once I, once I'm in another place, I can actually, I can actually maybe see some kind of relevance to it. But right now, you know, it's not quite there. So that's basically... I'd like both speakers to perhaps respond to that sort of, to that statement.
Okay. You want to start? I'll start so I can see.
I understand why you're saying that. But remember that going back to prehistory and maybe 80,000 years ago when it appears Homo sapiens came on in Africa. We have, this is before, well before science and religion, right? And it's before you thought there was a simple answer to your question. And when you have, if you're painful, if your relative is dying, one of the strongest things is you go back to nature, in quotes. Take your grief to nature. What does that mean? Take it to the cosmos. Your grief is as big as the cosmos. Remember, who was it that was talking about the stars out there as the jewelry? I don't think what You know, I can understand if I have a terminal illness and someone talks about the multiverse, I might say, go away. But at the same time, I might go out and relate to it. And that's what I think the landscape art and art generally tries.
I don't know whether I can answer your question really deeply, but, you know, when I think about the sky, I always remember, people do not look at the sky anymore. I mean, you know, you have telescopes, you have beautiful images on the internet. But just remind you that about people in prehistoric time, as you were saying, what were they doing at night? The only thing you can do is just watch the sky and tell stories. And I think it's deeply rooted inside us, our connection to the sky and telling stories. And if you look at the constellation, they are all, I mean, in our traditions, and each of the constellation is coming from a Greek myth. And so we have put our stories in the sky, and we have a connection to the sky that we are losing because we are in cities with a lot of light. Of course, we have telescopes. I've done experiments with kids in schools, and as I'm, I mean, can you see the moon during the day? Most of them, they know about the moon. They can explain you why it's changing its shape. But they have never, you know, just look at the moon like that. So I ask them to draw the moon for 1 month, like every day. And then they realize that, well, you can see it during the day. Sometimes you can't see it. This connection is lost because we are just looking at the world through a computer. And as a teacher, I think it's important to say, I want to question the world, not the image of the world that people are putting on the internet through a computer. And for me, this is what I want to try to understand. And of course, it doesn't answer very deep questions about the meaning of life. But as I said, my work is not to answer all the questions. It's just to define small questions to which I can give some answers. And this give new ingredient to the debate. Because all what we have learned in fundamental physics today, it raises this idea of the multiverse that we can like or not like. This is a metaphysical question. We have been arguing at length whether it exists or not. We can like it or not like it, but science gives you some elements, some arguments for and some arguments against. But the final answer, we won't get it. And I think I'm not here to give you answers, I'm just elements to have a deeper thinking on all these elements. So.
Yeah, Paul Mateney. It's related, actually, because one of the things that affects my well-being in a negative way is when that bit, as it were, between personal spirituality and the colliding galaxies isn't addressed, which is the ecosystem. I love the designs that you do. I just would be interested to know if you ever include in your more soft landscaping any sort of ecological gardening? Gardening for ecosystems, for diversity? And if so, how? And if not, why not?
Well, if not, because I haven't been asked and I'm not good at ecology. I'm all in favor of supporting ecology, but it would be folly to try to think up elephants and bees if I were doing it. Okay, the ecological paradigm I support fully, but I like to grow different variety of things. In fact, paradise garden botany is based on the infinite variety of God, and that is a symbolic program that I follow in planting. So if I took you through the DNA garden and I showed you all the different plants I planted, it would explain how they're related. And I just, I work at a level because that's where I work, but it's not as, I come back to the previous point. You know, the meaning, the personal meaning of life is, I think, a valid question, and which we try to face in Maggie Centers. And I don't agree with Steven Weinberg, Bernard, who said, the more we study the universe, the more meaningless it becomes. I think that's a completely trite view, and for many reasons, because I think the more I study the universe, the more meaningful it gets. Actually, the universe starts out rather boring in supersymmetry, but ever since then it's been breaking symmetry, and it's fuller, more and more. So the plurality is itself a wonderful thing, and even our existence in it is a wonderful part of that. So I reject dogmatic atheism. I really do. And Weinbergian view of growth, sort of like Bertrand Russell, saying, it's all so tragic. It's not. It's full of meaning, and it's getting more meaningful every day.
Thanks very much. That's great. Yes. I'd just like to thank both speakers, but I haven't thanked individually Charles for his talk this morning, which I think brought into almost a sort of concrete form a lot of the things that we've been talking about, and was finely balanced between the harmony and the disharmony and the beauty and the ugliness and the chaotic and the order. And that this is really what we're all sort of navigating really in life, isn't it, as Paul was implying over there. So I'd like you to join me in thanking Charles very much for his talk. Thank you.